stepping off the edge. You can help your friends start learning. Stepping off the edge. You can arm yourself with knowledge. Stepping off the edge. They can't stop social barriers from falling. Stepping off the edge.
Hello, I'm your host, Jamie O, and I welcome you to the 24th episode of the podcast, Civil Disobedience, which was produced in November 2012. The guest this month is Andy Bickelbaum, who along with Mike Bonanno formed the wonderful creative activist duo commonly known as the Yes Men. For those who've never heard of them, here's a brief bio from their Kickstarter campaign, which I'll explain in just a moment. The Yes Men are an activist duo known for their outrageous satirical interventions at business events, on the internet, television, and in the streets. Their award-winning documentaries, The Yes Men and The Yes Men Fix the World, chronicle their mind-blowing pranks that expose and publicize vital issues at critical times. They've offered several books, lectured internationally on art and social change, and are the founders of the Yes Lab, an educational organization devoted to training next-generation activists. They want to produce a third movie which completes a trilogy of funny feature documentaries they started a decade ago. In their first film, The Yes Men, they posed as spokespeople for the World Trade Organization, acting out comedic vigilante justice against the elite. In The Yes Men Fix the World, they delivered a bunch of hard-hitting, hilarious stunts that show why we must change our corporation's first system, and what's in store if we don't. Their goals for The Yes Men are revolting, aim to deliver an even more jam-packed with screwball comedy, nail-biting suspense, nasty stings, and informative documentary. It'll also have a gripping personal storyline the first two films lacked, as well as a human-staffed platform to convert viewer enthusiasm into direct action, letting everyone join in the fun and contribute to the movement for change. As far as music or media go this month, there's some snippets from the Yes Men Fix the World trailer, the audio from an Alan Watts talk entitled What If Money Didn't Matter, which I discovered by way of the wonderful Edge Steppin' friend Ed Y from Quebec, Standing Up, which is a 2-bit remix of great lyrics by Lonnie Ray Atkinson, who graciously shares all his musical talents through ccmixter.org, and I believe I've included one or two of his songs on previous episodes. There's also the audio from two very different videos which creatively explore the ideas and impact of capitalism, which Andy and I get into discussing in the latter half of the interview. And rounding out the episode is a small snippet from an hour-long remix entitled Approaching Farewell by YouTuber Mr. Suicide Sheep. I was listening to it while working on the cover art for this month's episode, and some of the memorable lines from Charlie Chaplin's movie The Great Dictator came across my headphones. The title for this month's episode comes out of one question that I had asked Andy about that stemmed from an interview he gave to the Commonwealth Club that I'd listened to a podcast of. I'll include a link to that podcast in the show notes because it was a really good piece of media, and I think for anybody who hasn't heard of the Yes Men or are more interested in how some of the previous hoaxes came together, it fills in a lot of those blanks. I think that's about it as far as episode introduction goes. I would like to put an offer out there to anybody who has found themselves enjoying the Steppin' Off the Edge podcast, but would like to see it happen on a more frequent basis. This would be the spot where I'd probably put in some sort of a soft pitch, asking for people to make donations through PayPal to jamie@steppinofftheedge.com, but knowing where my schedule's at right now, it's probably unrealistic to have me putting out more than one episode per month. So here's an alternative. Step off the edge with me. I'd like to think that across the 20-plus interviews and ghost cast episodes of the podcast, I've fleshed out the general directions I'd like society to step towards. And the interviews recorded for the podcast are my attempt to help promote people who are taking steps in those directions. But that's just my perspective mixed in with good conversations with guests. If you have an idea you'd like to explore, a conversational interview you'd like to have with someone, or anything you feel is a step off the edge in the right direction, get in touch with me. I'd not only love to hear about it, but I'm also quite willing to share the hosting opportunities for the podcast, in addition to helping with the technology side if you're interested but don't feel that you have the podcasting capabilities. There's a number of easy ways to get in touch with me. Either email jamie@steppinofftheedge.com, via Twitter @steppofftheedge, or through the website steppingofftheedge.com. Up next, my interview with Yes Man Andy Bicklebaum. Until next episode, I hope that you will be happy, healthy, and hopeful.
It was a creed written into the founding documents that declared the destiny of a nation. Yes, we can. It was whispered by slaves and abolitionists as they blazed a trail towards freedom through the darkest of nights. Yes, we can. It was sung by immigrants as they struck out from distant shores and pioneers who pushed westward against an unforgiving wilderness. Yes, we can. It was the call of workers who organized, women who reached for the ballot, a president who chose the moon as our new frontier, and a king who took us to the mountaintop and pointed the way to the promised land. Yes, we can to justice and equality.
So I'm joined today on the podcast by Andy Bicklebaum, who is, in his own terms, revolting. Self-described yes man, he's one of the two people pitching the newest funny feature documentary as a last resort to take back democracy, that looks to get viewers out of your seats and into the streets, and join their corporate watchdog group that bites. Andy, thanks for stepping off the edge.
Oh, thank you, Jamie.
I know you guys are based in New York. How was your Sandy experience?
It was harmless for us. For me, you know, I mean, I live very high up in a building, so I had to climb up and down, and there was no water, but it was actually quite fun. Interruption of daily routine was very enjoyable. But then I went to the Rockaways. Mike and I drove down there with some supplies and just to see what we could do, and that was quite an eye-opener. It's really destroyed, and the only experience I've had that's anything like that is visiting New Orleans a year after Katrina and seeing what that had done. Yeah, it was a very intense experience, I guess, overall.
I can imagine. I'm a little bit north of the border in Ontario from you guys, and it was just a big rainstorm. There wasn't anywhere near the damage in this area that was seeing on TV and videos across the internet, at least.
Yeah, well, here it was a big rainstorm, too. I actually walked around during the storm here, pretty close to the eye of it, and it wasn't that bad. It was a bit frightening because there were trees swaying all over the place, but then what it actually did to, you know, our infrastructure seems to be so fragile that just any little thing that you do to it really throws it for a loop, which is incredibly frightening given that we're doing a lot to destabilize it these days. But the great news that came out of the hurricane, I think, I mean, there were a couple of pieces of really great news, I thought. The Occupy response was incredible. And, you know, Occupy just sprang to life in this network of people that they've been developing and has been quite active since the eviction from Zuccotti Park. Just, they've been doing stuff the whole time, it turns out, and they are really good at disaster relief, and they outperformed all of the underfunded agencies, all the agencies that are struggling to, you know, have a budget at all in this crazy market-driven age of ours. Occupy could just step in and fill their shoes, but it's really great that they exist.
Did you guys have much involvement or experience with Occupy when it was first in Zuccotti Park?
Yeah, we spent a lot of time there, hanging out, enjoying it, brainstorming actions with people. Generally, we did a couple of actions, a few actions actually, and just mainly really feeding off the wonderful vibe. And then after the eviction, it became a lot harder for people to be involved. It wasn't just like a matter of going to a park and being there. But fortunately, a lot of people really remained committed and to the spirit of it and to what it had started revolution-wise and kept working in really important ways behind the scenes.
I noticed there was one thing I saw recently was they've started to create a debt jubilee program that's, I think, come out of some of the Occupy program and another website, strikedebt.org.
Yes, it's a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful website. and it's a wonderful idea. And it's, yeah, it's been amazingly successful, I think. I mean, it's mainly about getting press, obviously, and getting attention for this question of debt and what is debt and who is determining who owes what and why. You know, those big questions. And it's been incredibly successful at talking about those things and getting those things into the media. Just the same way Zuccotti was really very, and the Occupy movement was very successful at getting the question of inequality into the media. So, yeah, that's a really great program, I think.
And maybe for some people that aren't familiar with it, what they're actually doing is basically buying up debt for pennies on the dollar, but instead of collecting it, they're abolishing it through mutual support and goodwill, and to say, debt, it occurred, it happened, but it's become so much more than the particular financial instrument that it was meant to serve, and there's all of it just sort of floating in that financial system. And I think a program like this Debt Jubilee just points out how silly it is that you can buy something that's not real for like a fraction of its price and just make it go away, and the system keeps on humming, so to speak.
Yeah, well, of course. I mean, it's a drop in the bucket, of course. You know, Occupy has bought $500,000 worth of debt that they've raised, and that amounts to about $10 million worth of actual, like, what people owe on paper, and they just have abolished that. But that, of course, is the tiniest drop in the bucket of what our debt actually is. But, you know, this debt is almost all debt that poor people owe rich people. And when rich people incur debts between themselves, they don't treat it the same way. They write it off at that point. Or they get poor people to bail them out.
So maybe change gears a little bit. For some of the people who aren't entirely familiar with you, I know on the yesmen.org website you have a whole frequently asked questions sections. Reading through those, it did bring up some sort of jumping off questions there that hopefully sort of rapid fire ones just to introduce people that aren't already familiar with you guys. Mm-hmm. What's the favorite hoax that you've done other than probably the one you're currently working on?
I think it might be the Chamber of Commerce one is one of our favorites, one of my favorites. But really, yeah, it's really hard to choose. I mean, they're all different, and they're successful in different ways or unsuccessful in different ways that are sometimes equally amusing success. but the Chamber one was both successful and unsuccessful in really interesting ways. We impersonated the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the largest lobbying organization in the world, and convinced the world that the chamber was no longer opposing climate change legislation that was making its way through the House at the time. And in the middle of the press conference that we threw for the chamber and posing as the chamber, a real chamber spokesperson burst into the conference. And the drama, which was quite intense, a lot of yelling and accusing, name-calling stuff, the drama was awesome, and it was viewed by tens of millions of people, thanks to the mainstream media's day-long news coverage. We videotaped it all and provided it to CNN and MSNBC and so on. And it was probably one of the many reasons that about 2 weeks later, the chamber reversed its opposition to the cap grade bill, the climate. So, I mean, there were a lot of other efforts as well that were contributing to that, but this was, I think, one of the reasons. And so it's on the level of, like, fitting into a strategy of changing things. It was a very powerful project. On the level of accidents happening and us learning things, it was great. Like, we had no idea that a real chamber spokesperson was going to burst in, and it turned out to be the best thing ever. So we learned something, thanks to the chair.
when I first watched that, having seen a couple of your documentaries, or movies, I should say, and some of the other ones you've done through the Yes Labs, my first thought was that that was actually someone that was in on the joke with you to portray sort of both sides of, well, obviously it's the Yes Men, you know, this isn't real, but that was a legitimate Chamber of Commerce staff member?
Yeah, that really was. And yeah, I think next time we do something like that, we will do as you suggest and get somebody to play that part.
Have you guys ever been reverse hoaxed?
Not really, no. No, not yet. We welcome the opportunity.
Are there any companies you wouldn't target?
Oh, sure. I mean, there's some companies it wouldn't really make sense to target because they're just run-of-the-mill companies that, you know, maybe sell something that people need and at a reasonable price and, you know, maybe pay their CEO only 10 times more than the average worker. Whatever. There's lots of companies that, I mean, we would target any company, sure, but there are a lot that just wouldn't be a good choice. But there are, unfortunately, there are many, many opportunities to, many choices of really terrible companies to target. That said, it's not really any particular company that's the problem and that we're really targeting. Like, when we target a company, we're not targeting the company really. We're targeting the system that the company is a part of and that says this company should be doing that. So, like, when we impersonated Dow Chemical on the BBC in 2004, the BBC accidentally invited us to speak on the BBC on the 20th anniversary of the Bhopal catastrophe, and they thought they were getting Dow Chemical, and they got us.
Well, joining us live from Paris now is Jude Finisterre. He's a spokesman for Dow Chemical.
Today, I'm very happy to announce that for the first time, Dow is accepting full responsibility for the Bhopal catastrophe.
This interview was inaccurate.
The hoax was an elaborate one.
The prank knocked 3% off Dow's shares.
Well, I wouldn't say it's a hoax. It's an honest representation of what Dow should be doing.
You know, Dow is a terrible company. That's a given. They bought the company responsible for the largest industrial disaster in history, the Bhopal catastrophe, and they refused to do anything to remediate the disaster, to clean up the site or compensate the victims or anything. And they're as bad as companies come. But we got a real lesson in why they don't do anything for the victims in Bhopal. Because really, it wouldn't cost them that much. It would cost them a few hundred million dollars, I guess. But compared to their bottom line, it's not that much. The reason was, as we found out, that if they did anything, stock would plummet. And that's exactly happened on behalf of Dow on the BBC in front of what the BBC said was 350 million viewers. I announced that Dow was responsible for the Bhopal catastrophe, would compensate the survivors, would clean up the site, etc. And in the ensuing 20 minutes, while the world thought that that was true, Dow's stock value lost like $2 or $3 billion. And then as soon as it was revealed to be a hoax, it came right back up. So, you know, there's lots of bad companies, and we target them for, you know, specific reasons, but really it's the system that companies for doing the right thing that we need to be thinking about. We need to be thinking about making societal decisions that reward companies for doing the right thing and that decide, you know, like, say, establishing a carbon tax, making it really expensive to produce too much carbon. Then companies would do it because there would be a punishment for doing the wrong thing. And right now, we don't have that kind of a thing. We're completely at the mercy of these companies who have decided what the rules should be. Somehow, we've let them do that. We need to start making rules.
Yeah, it was in another interview or article that you had written that I think it was trying to get the idea of aligning profit with public good.
Yeah.
And I know there's been a bunch of things written or trying to bring up, like, B corporations or benefit corporations that allow them to have the idea of a social impact or their environmental focus on equal footing with the financial goals that they have as an organization.
Yeah.
Some have written about triple bottom lines.
Sure, there's lots of great models. There's no challenge really in finding good models of doing things. I mean, you can look at Finland, for example, and they have some good things going on there. It's very cold, and they speak a ridiculous language, but they have wonderful healthcare, and they have free education, and they take care of people, and yet they make a lot of money. So, it's not very hard to find good examples, ways to do things. The problem is, the real challenge for us is not to invent B corporations or whatever. It's to get the majority of Americans on the side of doing the right thing and of taking control of democracy, or, you know, as some might have it, establishing democracy. Yeah, there's a lot of different ways to do that. And what we do is just one little part of that, but that's the challenge.
What percentage of people would you say right now are actively involved in democracy?
Yeah, I don't know. I think it depends what part of it you're looking at. Like, apparently some very large number of people in the United States think there's too much money in politics. I forget what the number is. It's something like 80%, and that's across both party lines. So I think in some domains it's probably very high, but then there's other domains like, I don't know, healthcare, education, where people have bought the lies. And, you know, even though we spend more on healthcare than any other country on earth, we have less access to healthcare. And that preposterous situation somehow people accept on the basis of this argument that you need to have a free market in things, including basic human rights. And that's just completely ridiculous. But you can't have rules that benefit people rather than rules that benefit corporations. So there's a lot of work to be done in a lot of ways. But I'm not a statistician, and I don't know, really.
I would imagine your network is probably pretty filled with people who are moving in that direction that you see as positive just by the nature of what it is that you do.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of people out there but that want to do the right thing. It's just really mustering people on the other side and figuring out how to get them to see what their interest is. That's the real challenge.
What do you desire? What makes you itch? What sort of a situation would you like? Let's suppose, I do this often in vocational guidance of students. They come to me and say, we're getting out of college and we haven't the faintest idea what we want to do. So I always ask the question, what would you like to do if money were no object? How would you really enjoy spending your life? Well, it's so amazing. As a result of our kind of educational system, crowds of students say, we'd like to be painters, we'd like to be poets, we'd like to be writers, but as everybody knows, you can't earn any money that way. Or another person says, I'd like to live an out-of-doors life and ride horses. I say, do you want to teach in a riding school? Let's go through with it. What do you want to do? When we finally got down to something which the individual says he really wants to do, I will say to him, you do that. And forget the money. Because if you say that getting the money is the most important thing, you will spend your life completely wasting your time. You'll be doing things you don't like doing in order to go on living, that is, to go on doing things you don't like doing, which is stupid. Better to have a short life that is full of what you like doing than a long life spent in a miserable way. And after all, if you do really like what you're doing, it doesn't matter what it is, you can eventually turn it, you could eventually become a master of it. It's the only way to become a master of something, to be really with it. And then you'll be able to get a good fee for whatever it is. So don't worry too much. Somebody's interested in everything. And anything you can be interested in, you'll find others who are. But it's absolutely stupid to spend your time doing things you don't like in order to go on spending things you don't like and doing things you don't like and to teach your children
following the same track. See, what we're doing is we're bringing up children and educating them to live the same sort of lives we're living, in order that they may justify themselves and find satisfaction in life by bringing up their children, to bring up their children to do the same thing, so it's all wretch and no vomit. It never gets there. And so, therefore, it's so important to consider this question: what do I desire?
One of the other interviews that I think it was you or possibly you and Mike had given at the Commonwealth Club in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
I'd listened to it as a podcast, and there were two quotes in there that really stood out, which I'm hoping you can expand upon a little bit. You had just touched on that people have bought the lies. And one of the quotes that you gave was that the audience believing you makes you feel you are not a fake, in regards to putting on that persona of Tao or any of the different hoaxes you've done.
Mm-hmm.
How do you react to that, or does that help you in the hoax?
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of just like a feature of human beings, I guess, that we like to believe things, and we're really good at imagination. So if you go to a film and you see a film, you believe it. It's true, even though you pretty much know that it's not three-dimensional. Or if you go to a play, it's three-dimensional, but you kind of pretty much know these actors are just actors. They're not really doing these things. But you forget for extended periods of time and get really wrapped up and, you know, shield your eyes, and it really works. So it's the same with these things. I think what I was probably saying is that when you're, you know, when you're pretending to be a representative of a company, and everybody in the audience automatically is believing that you are that person because you're listed in the program, so why should they not? Then their belief that that's happening ends up working on you, and you start forgetting that you're, you know, an actor actually has to be good at fooling people. But like doing this kind of thing, you don't actually have to be much of an actor, because the audience ends up convincing you and making you a good actor, because you don't have to be. You don't have to fool anybody.
In the movies and plays, there's that idea of the suspension of disbelief, that if something's not real or it's not even plausible, your mind won't accept it. But for the hoaxes that you guys do, you've already crossed that barrier because of the fact that people are just expecting this is who you say you are, so to speak.
Yeah, thanks. That's right. It's reverse suspension of disbelief. The audience suspends your disbelief instead of the other way around.
The other quote from that podcast was that civil disobedience is a key missing ingredient of today's democracy.
Yeah, it's really critical. Voting is really important, and it's really important to elect the lesser of two evils, or somebody who will not actively fight in certain ways for a really bad thing. Somebody who's amenable, at least seems amenable to progressive pressure. And that would be Obama versus Romney in our country. And that's really important. But really it's important because he seems amenable to public pressure. So the next component is the public pressure. And, you know, when people say, oh, he's not actually progressive, and, you know, how disappointing. Well, yeah, he never pretended to be progressive. He just kind of had this advertising campaign to get elected the first time that was all about progressiveness. But that's still really useful to elect somebody like that, because then they have to pretend to be progressive. And if you really apply pressure and hold their feet to the fire, then they can't just like turn around and say, I disagree with you, because they said they do agree with you. And if you really apply that pressure in a really strong way, you can achieve stuff with somebody like that in office. And that's the way the New Deal was passed in the 30s. It wasn't that Roosevelt was really wonderful. It was that people applied a lot of pressure to him and rioted in the streets, demanding the sort of things that he put into effect.
And You're seeing a lot of that in Spain and across in Europe. And I know Montreal is having a number of student-led sort of protests that are filling the streets, and you're seeing some of that come out through mass media.
Right.
Is there a particular reason you think that hasn't begun to happen in the U.S., or it's happening, but it's just not being promoted?
Yeah, it is happening here. It's just a different place. And it's happening in a different way. Occupy was a face of that. And it was a big media phenomenon for a while, even though it was just the occupation of a park. It was a really huge phenomenon and spread all over the world. And that is the form that it could take at that time. And now it's taking other forms, like you mentioned, the Rolling Jubilee, and there's Occupy Sandy, the hurricane relief stuff, and all the other community work that they're doing. It's, you know, it's unclear what form things have to take. They don't always take the form of large protests. There have been actual revolutions in history recently where there were no large protests, at least not until the end, where things happened in different ways. And, you know, right now around the world, you see a lot of large protests that are achieving a lot of change, and that's amazing. But it's not necessarily the way it's going to happen here. And by revolution, I just mean dramatic improvement. It doesn't necessarily change, of course.
On the project that you guys are probably most excited about right now is your attempt to become revolting, or the new documentary that you're putting together, a Kickstarter campaign. And at the current point in time, there's about 7 days left to go. You've reached your $100,000 goal and currently at around $105,000, and you've set a stretch goal for $200,000. Do you want to explain a bit about if people are interested in getting involved in that, either what they get or the larger project that comes about as a result of that?
Yeah, we're really excited about this film, for one thing, but the film is about motivating people to take action. And so in addition to the film, we're also building a kind of platform, a human-staffed platform. It'll give every viewer of our film, as well as anybody, it'll give them a way to plug directly into ongoing direct actions or get help starting new actions and getting collaborators. So it's kind of, you know, Match.com for social change with a human matchmaker to more efficiently transform inspiration from the film or whatever into action. And we really think that the film will inspire a lot of people. For one thing, the last film inspired a lot of people. A lot of people wrote in and said they wanted to do something. They were excited to get active, and we really had nothing to tell them besides, you know, go figure it out. There's all kinds of ways to get active. This time, it's going to be different. We're actually going to have a platform we can tell people to go to, plug in. We're working with some large organizations like Greenpeace and 350.org to craft projects and give people, help stimulate ideas. It'll also be a place where people can come up with their own ideas around goals of their own and get help doing that. So we're really excited about that. And that's one of the reasons we need money.
And you mentioned that there's a human component in there. If I take what you just described in terms of creating the Match.com system, there's probably already some pieces of that out there.
Oh, yeah.
How is what you plan to build for that switchboard not necessarily going to be so revolutionary and different, but why is the human component so important to it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the technology is not actually going to be that original. Most of it exists. We'll have to code a few little pieces, but not much. The main thing will be seeing, like, having people behind the scenes, we're calling them operators, look at project ideas or people who want to participate in projects and figure out ways that those things can happen. So, like, if somebody writes in with a great idea, the operator can kind of massage it, work it over a little bit, develop it a little, and then publicize it and get collaborators, and then provide project leader with a little platform to discuss and post and all that. But, you know, discussing and posting and all that is not advanced. We know how to do that. That exists. That's existed for a while. So it's mainly this person behind the scenes who kind of helps make things happen. And we feel certain this is going to work because a number of projects lately have been happening, partly as part of what we're calling the Yes Lab and partly just independently, where people write in and say, hey, I've got this project, I want to do this or that. We write back and we say, that's amazing, you might want to think about this. Then they'll write back with a little improvement and maybe a question about legal consequences. We write back the little answer, and boom, the project happens, and it's really successful. So we think if that just happens spontaneously every once in a while, if we have a platform devoted to making that happen, it can happen a lot. That's our theory.
And I'm guessing the focus isn't specifically on the creative hoax elements that sort of Yes Men have been known for, but really that's a tip of the iceberg of the larger idea of change projects, if you will.
Right, yeah, anything that involves thinking creatively to have an effect. Yeah, and hoax is just one of many, many, many things you can do creatively to get things changing, to bring attention to issues so that people are kind of mobilized and galvanized to take action. Yeah.
You mentioned the Yes Labs there, and how is the Yes Lab different than what you're envisioning coming about through the dashboard, or the switchboard, sorry?
It's really not different. It's just that the switchboard is remote. So far, the Yes Lab has been all in person and local, like geographically in one place. So we've had these brainstorms with people locally and helped develop projects and answered questions and so on. And we do that every week we have a brainstorm with people. There's four different projects ongoing at the current time, and we brainstorm ideas with people and have them trade tips between them. And the only difference with the switchboard is that it'll happen remotely, and these things will happen through Skype or whatever. So it opens up the field for a lot more.
If someone signs up to the Kickstarter and they get their super secret decoder ring, does that enable them to be an operator, or there's a bit of a conversation that has to happen to figure out how those people become operators to power the platform, if you will?
Yeah, operators will probably be veterans of projects, people who have pulled off projects successfully. Any of them can become operators and give advice to and kind of help other projects manage themselves and figure out what to do. So there's currently probably 5 or 10 people that would be very qualified to be operators. The secret decoder ring will provide excellent, very exciting things, but not that.
So the Kickstarter wraps up in a week or so.
Yeah.
Do you have a sense of when you're aiming for the movie to come out and the switchboard to come online?
The movie's probably going to come, well, the movie will be finished, we hope, by summertime. The switchboard, we're in the process of making it now and beginning to develop it and flesh it out. And that'll be a long process, but we hope also by summertime to have a working, fully fledged version.
Takes people in the streets. It was force, not given force. It was forced, not given, forced, not given. It takes people in the streets, forced to voices, actions, and sacrifice. It takes people in the streets. Have you signed your name to the street? Well then repeat, brothers and sisters, repeat. I ain't no pacifist, but I got a peace sign and a fist up in the air for nonviolent resistance. They call us terrorists when the company's losing profits from my exercise of civil disobedience. I ain't no masochist, but I'm ready to suffer if it means less suffering in the long run. You call the bulls out, we'll turn the cameras on and let the world see which one is the strong one. You make them criminalize you.
Standing up for justice, standing up for justice.
Show the world your crime.
Standing up for justice, standing up for justice.
And when they call your name.
Standing up for justice, standing up for justice. Standing up for justice,
you make them criminalize you.
Standing up for justice, standing up for justice.
Show the world your crime.
Standing up for justice, standing up for justice.
And when they call your name.
Standing up for justice, standing up for justice.
Make sure the world sees your crime.
Standing up for justice, standing up for justice.
What do they want?
Order!
What do they want?
Order!
What do we want?
Justice!
What will we accept?
Nothing less than justice!
Maybe changing gears a bit back to some of the questions we were getting into around sort of capitalism and the larger thought concepts. You had touched upon the challenges that you came across with Dow Chemical and how the stock market won't allow companies to do the right thing. It really operates under the assumption that if the company is doing well in the stock market, the employees must be as well, which everybody, I think, recognizes isn't the case. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious, if the Yes Men had a blank canvas right now and you could design a better stock exchange system, what types of things would you like to see measured and how would it reward or encourage companies to do the right thing?
Wow. I mean, I could just wing it, I guess, and say all kinds of things, but I don't feel like it's my expertise. Thinking of different ways to do things is not that hard. Like, you could reward all kinds of different things. You could even not change things much and do things much better without radically changing everything. I mean, I think it would be great to radically change everything too. That's, you know, nothing against that. Reward happiness. Find a way to do that. Reward companies that promote happiness. I don't know how you would do this. I'm not an expert, but you could also just tweak the system that exists to not hurt people as much, and that would be pretty revolutionary as well. Like, have a real healthcare system that automatically takes care of everybody for free, the way many countries do. Or have an education system that doesn't put you in debt and your family in debt forever and ever, as almost all other countries do. You know, there's all kinds of very easy solutions. Not easy, but, you know, they're not particularly imaginative solutions that dramatically improve life. And all you have to do is look around to other places. And these are, you know, there are some places that do things a lot better than we in the U.S. or Canada do, and that we could really adopt. I'd like as much as anybody to go off on a tangent and start thinking about wild, you know, possibilities, but that's not really politically what we need necessarily. Like, what we need is just hard work, getting people to recognize that the way things are right now is dramatically against the interest of people, and we have to change that. And the way to change it, there's lots of examples. There's so many alternatives all over the place. You know, spends a lot of time trying to tell us there is no alternative. That's one of the things that neoliberalism tries to tell us, and it's just obviously false and a no-brainer to see that it's false. And that's more important to see than to find a particular answer.
Fair enough. Some of the things I'm hoping to get to in some episodes in the future deal around, like, Bitcoin, that allow the distribution of money or the method in which people interact that's not based on a currency tied to any particular government necessarily, or like couch surfing. And there are lots of websites that are bringing up this idea of the sharing economy that allow everybody to benefit rather than the sort of top-down approach that comes from a corporate perspective.
Sure. These things are wonderful. Really great. Couchsurfing, Bitcoin, for that matter, Debt Jubilee, you know, wonderful things. But, you know, the danger with all these things is that you see them as a solution and that this is going to really fix everything. The solutions are right in front of us and really obvious and not particularly interesting. You know, it doesn't really stimulate the imagination much to think of national health care that takes care of everyone, at least in the U.S. You know, that's not particularly exciting to people in the U.S. because Canadians do that. You know, like, it's right there. It's not like utopian pie in the sky thinking. It's not a challenge to think about it, but that's the kind of thing we need, and that's the kind of thing that's right there. You know, if we get there, then maybe it would be nice to think of couch surfing as a solution to everything, or Bitcoin, or, you know, these other kind of utopian possibilities. But I think, you know, it's the danger again is that we think those are really where we should put our energy, and where we should put our energy is countering evil and basically promoting obvious good solutions to things.
And I think to pick just one industry in terms of food, you can sort of look at a bit of that techno-utopianism with the idea of GMO crops and bioengineering and all those sorts of things. Or we already have a pretty good history of how to grow food organically, locally, and those are two solutions. But, I mean, we have a track record with one. We know it works. It can scale. It's easy. It's cost efficient.
Yeah.
Why are we investing so much time, energy, and brain power towards trying to build this great other thing if we already have something that's pretty good that we can, you know, work to augment in small ways, perhaps? Some of the stuff I've looked at it with permaculture answers that to an exceptional degree.
Yeah, totally. And the reason, to answer your question, why we're investing so much to build this big other thing is because it's immensely profitable. And so if you want to make billions of dollars on food, you can't really do it augmenting local production in small ways and making this thing that works work a little better or whatever, or spreading it. You can't make immense fortunes that way. You can make immense fortunes monopolizing land, setting up a system that produces one crop instead of 20, and cranking it out for export, and so you get a lot of money. That's the reason that that system exists. And until we change that rule that you can do whatever you want to make a giant fortune, in any way, no matter what its effect on people, we're going to keep having things like that.
And some of those aspects you describe are at the heart of capitalism, which, you know, Western culture has put out there and said, this is the way forward to prosperity for all. But is capitalism worth saving if that's like a very core principle about it?
Oh, God, no. I mean, if that's what capitalism is, then no, we should get rid of it. I don't actually know what capitalism is, so I don't know. I'll be agnostic. But if that's what it is, then we should get rid of it.
I sort of see those two things very synonymous, whereas you get the sharing economy model and open source. They're existing within that ecosystem of capitalism, but they seem sort of very different from that. But I look at all those different concepts, and it just stands out to me. It's like, open source makes sense, closed source doesn't. Permaculture and sharing local food makes sense, GMO doesn't. It keeps coming back to the same question of, you know, why do people want to make such profit-oriented decisions when doing things that benefit everybody makes more sense for the whole of the planet?
Right. Well, yeah, I the method of extracting the most money possible regardless of the consequences to people is obviously a very old feature of what we call capitalism, or of the system that we're in. And, you know, it's of course responsible for the Irish potato famine, and Jonathan Swift's Modest Proposal was all about that, how England was basically monopolizing Ireland's export crop. But, you know, I'm not sure how much that's inherent to the definition of capitalism. Yeah, it would be good to look into that.
This is the capitalist. Look at it run in slow motion. It's totally cool. It runs the world. Just look at it all over this place. Watch out, says the pink coat. Oh, look at it being all tough, chasing that welfare abuser. Go capitalism! Look at this arrogant government snake. Capitalism doesn't care, it just smacks the shit out of him. Let me legislate, says the whiny snake. Capitalism doesn't care. He just wants to make a profit. Oh look, there he is getting dirty for money.
Captain Capitalism! Wow! What are you doing here?
I think the better question, son, is just what do you think you're doing here?
Putting money in my piggy bank.
Crippling our nation by stagnating the economy and throwing us into another recession is more like it, commie.
What?
You see, son, money was made to be spent. Money needs to be spent. Money that just sits around collecting dust doesn't help anyone. Money must be exchanged for goods and services, not kept in cages or pigs. If money isn't spent, it gets depressed because it's not fulfilling its purpose. You don't want your money to be sad, do you?
Gosh, no. But I'm trying to save up for college.
You don't need to worry about that yet. You may not be smart enough to get into college anyway. And if you are, that's what credit card debt and federally assisted loans are for. By paying interest later in life, you'll only be making our economy stronger. One day, you'll be old enough to understand that.
Well, sometimes I want to buy comics from Mr. Manley's newsstand on the corner.
That's my point. You see, that's how Mr. Manley makes his living. Every time you buy a comic book from Mr. Manley, he gets to keep some of the money, which he uses to get food and shelter for his family. If people don't buy comics from Mr. Manley, he won't be able to afford those things. His family will be forced out of their home, have to eat garbage, and they'll all eventually die.
Gee, I never thought of it like that.
There's more. Some of the money will go to the people who created the comics, keeping them off the street, which is good for society because most of them are degenerate perverts. But the lion's share of the money goes to the corporations who distribute and market what you buy. These corporations then use their money to buy politicians and other people to influence the decisions that have made us the most powerful nation on the planet. Without benevolent corporations protecting us, the world would descend into complete anarchy and chaos, and our enemies would have us by the balls.
I think I understand now.
With the Yes Men gaining in popularity, I'm sure there's situations where you've had hoaxes nearly blow apart just by someone coming up to you and recognizing you. And the actor Nathan Fillion, who is the lead on the cult classic space western Firefly,
has been a particular kind of experience for me where I said on, when we were doing Firefly and we got canceled, I went on the message board and said, look, we're all heartbroken. I really was. But if you ever see me on the street, don't come up to me and go, oh, I can't believe it's canceled until I can relive this thing.
Right.
Just, if you see me, just stop. Nod and say, Captain. And I'll know you mean all that other stuff. I'll know that that's what you mean. That whole thing, and I wrote this whole thing.
And naturally, people
I'll
do
know
that.
That's what you mean. And I've met people who see me and they have that look of, did you hear that? And they immediately calm themselves, Captain. And I love it.
So, is there something you'd like to suggest to Yes Men fans who see you in public that they either do or don't do that might help your future hoaxes get pulled off more successfully?
Well, just on the level of personal desires, I really I find it exhausting when people come up and say, oh, hey, you guys should go after Monsanto, or have you guys ever done something around the arms industry or things like that? And I always have to say, well, why don't you do something around Monsanto or the arms industry? And here's where you can go to find out more about how to do this. Not that I even need to tell them where to go because it's just out there on our website. But, you know, if people want us to go after somebody and they think that we really should, please don't tell us that. Just do it yourself. or write it down you know, say, hey, I'm going to go after the arms industry. Do you have any advice? That we're really happy to answer that kind of questions. I find that question really exciting. I find really noxious when people say, you guys should go after X or Y, because that's just giving up responsibility. And we don't have time to go after everybody. We're busy. But it's not hard to do this kind of work. It's not rocket science. It's pretty simple. It's just taking things that a lot of people know how to do better than us and putting them together in a certain order. And we're happy to tell you what that order is. We've written it down in all kinds of ways on our website and elsewhere, and it's easy to find.
I know a couple others that I saw was actopedia.org, destructibles.org, and then the book Beautiful Trouble that you also have a website for.
Yeah, Beautiful Trouble is a really useful resource that describes a lot of actions and the principles behind them, not just ours, but a lot of them. And we've also got some documents about, you know, specific things like how to write a press release, how to put on a press conference, and all those things as well.
So is there any kind of hoax that you could do that would be so incredible that you'd hang up your hoaxing jacket and retire altogether?
Not if it was a hoax. Oh, boy. Now, that's actually a really good question. I don't have a pat answer for that. Wow. You know, I'll just have to think about that. If there were a hoax, I mean, if there was some action, whether it was a hoax or not, if there was an action that we could do that would really convince the, you know, 20-30% of Americans who don't realize that we should have healthcare and education and money should get out of politics and so on, if we could do an action that would convince them of that, that would be amazing. Then I'd be completely satisfied and that would be that. But I'm afraid that's impossible. I don't think we can do that. I think that kind of change doesn't happen through this kind of action. I think this kind of action can motivate the people who are already on our side, but not so much convince people who are completely blind to this of its relevance and importance. So for that, we need actual organizing, people on the ground, walking around, talking to people, union organizers, that sort of thing.
So I'm guessing then there isn't going to be an Andy Bickelbaum campaign in 2016 for the presidency?
Oh, God. God forbid. That's not...
Andy, thank you very, very much for your time and for stepping off the edge.
All right. Thank you, Jamie.
I'm sorry, but I don't want to be an emperor. That's not my business. I don't want to rule or conquer anyone. I should like to help everyone if possible. Jew, Gentile, black man, white. We all want to help one another. Human beings are like that. We want to live by each other's happiness, not by each other's misery. We don't want to hate and despise one another. In this world, there's room for everyone, and the good earth is rich and can provide for everyone. The way of life can be free and beautiful. But we have lost the way. Greed has poisoned men's souls, has barricaded the world with hate, has goose-stepped us into misery and bloodshed. We have developed speed, but we have shut ourselves in. Machinery that gives abundance has left us in want. Our knowledge has made us cynical, our cleverness hard and unkind. We think too much, and